talent, or is that?
It's going to be a little bit of a challenge for me, just because I have a presentation slash lecture on Monday that's been eating my life. Because apparently I didn't know very much about Dirac strength and magnetic monopoles.
You should have been paying attention to kindergarten. So you guys, discuss amongst yourselves when you want to end. It's the deadline for me is when the marks have to be submitted, and the deadline for you is when you've got exams that you have to worry about.
About second Wednesday of April. Because first Wednesday of April, I have Passover, and therefore family obligations.
So it's really up to the rest of you guys.
Everyone not.
So who's against having it be second Wednesday in April? So I'll tell you what I'll do is I'll give people a chance in case that. You're a big threatening guy. Send an email if you'd rather not change it. Send me an email, and then the next class I can tell you what people said. Next class is the
20th. But the next class would be the due date otherwise.
I can email you back, but I haven't heard by Friday. Or
okay, so that's not a fun game.
Yeah.
Because then I just have to go with physical intimidation or something.
My sense is that it's not a big problem, but. Yeah, if you don't really put in a class, that'll be it. It's very rarely people worry about having it to do later. All right, any other questions? So I was going to flip on you. Oh, I have to do one thing. Oh, it's really good now. I was going to flip on you. Neutral meson mixing as a step between QCD and neutrino oscillations. And the motivation is, besides setting up oscillations, it's one of the best constraints on ways you can change the standard model. And I was at a meeting last week where one of the talks I skipped because I was skiing announced the discovery of D-bar mixing, I think. And the thing I was going to do and I forgot to do was to go check the website to just verify that's exactly what they did. But from talking to people afterwards in the bar, that's what they did. And so that's the section that if you're in that part of the book, there's two paragraphs on D-bar mixing which are expected to be too small to be observed for a while. Well, they've been observed. So that's a very interesting thing that's happened. So I'll check that for you again. Next time, but it's, if you want to check yourself, you can go to the site for the Morion 2007 Electro Week conference, because there were two talks by one of them was by Cleo C, and one of them was by, I forgot the other company, but the other collaboration one was very interesting. It was happening.
So what was the statement that Senegal made about?
Sorry?
What's the statement that Senegal made about
DD-bar mixing? Yeah, there's a whole bunch of neutral mesons, which I'll tell you about in a second, but the DD-bar mixing, I'll skip ahead just a second here a little bit, but basically what the kaon, the neutral kaon is basically a DS bar combination, and a K naught bar is a B bar S, and so B naught is a B B bar, and a K naught bar is a B B bar. But the D meson is a, seems to me it's a term up bar. I think the D bar is a term bar up. And there's a weird convention that the meson is the thing with the antique quark in it. So the strange meson has an anti-strange meson quark in it. The B meson has an anti-B meson in it. And that's because historically they found the strange mesons before they figured out what the quarks were. And they conventionally assign this guy strange number one. And then it turned out that was the thing with the anti-quark in it. So they, it means that the conventionally the strange quark carries strangeness minus one. And so then the convention was just to do that for all the down quarks, but then I think they didn't do that for the up quarks. So I'm pretty sure that D is the one with the C in it rather than C bar. I could say that the focus is for those. Yeah. So the thing is that these things, they're different from its antiparticle, but there's no conserved quantity that it carries that's exactly conserved, because strangeness is not exactly conserved, which forbids it from turning into, the propagation eigenstates are going to be some linear combination of these things. So they're going to propagate in a way which is not, these things don't just live separately. And so this has been seen for a long time, and this has been seen, the oscillation between these two things. This had never been seen. And the reason was that in the standard model, you're looking for a process, if you wanted to go from, say, K to K bar, that kind of a transition, you're looking for something that takes a D and an S quark, say that's a D, that's an S bar, and turns it into, say, an S and a D bar. So that's a kind of a graph where this is a W. That's a kind of graph that could take you from this to this. But then this is a, the thing in the middle here is an up quark, a charm quark, or a top quark. And you'll see that the amplitude here, it won't be clear now, but one of the main messages of today is that the amplitude for this is strongly, is proportional to the mass of the quark in here. So this whole thing is proportional to the M. So the top quark likes to win. In this case, it does win. In this case, it doesn't quite win because the mixing angles in the corners here for the top quarks, if you have down and strange, are small enough that they make it a little bit smaller than if you have a charm quark here. But it's proportional to the square of the mass of the thing on the internal line. So the thing is that for this same graph, in this case, would have been a charm up bar. WW, but that means that inside here you have a bottom strange and down quark. And these are all light. So if this thing goes like M bottom squared, say, you never get any. This is 170 GeV. I think I told you last time this year was 180, it was 170. And this is, 5 or less. And so the expectation is that this is much smaller than this. And so you've seen it in these things because you're seeing the amplification due to the top quark in here. Largely here, and it's less likely to see it here. But it's exactly whether you see it or not depends on matrix illness of this operator and things like that. So the surprise is they saw it. I don't know how surprised they were. I was kind of fairly surprised. At the meeting, people were surprised because they didn't announce they're going to announce something. But so I'll kind of give you more details about that in a second.
The surprising thing, you just said it's suppressed and it's on the meeting rate.
So it's been measured. It's not a deviation standard model, but it tells you, essentially, you see something like this, it's really useful, but it tells you, you'll see that these systems are, the reason they're so interesting is that the once you see transitions between these things, you learn something, you're learning about a very, very small corrections to the standard. You're learning things that are very sensitive to deviations from the standard model. And there's a statement about the fact that you expected the standard model contribution to be small would mean that something which is contributing from not in the standard model has less to compete with, so that you have a better chance of seeing something not in the standard model. So the first thing people are going to do is to look to see, is this standard model makes a very specific prediction as to all the properties you're going to see in this kind of oscillation. And it has to be the same parameters that are doing it here, doing it here, and doing it here. So there's a whole picture that has to hang together. And another one of the talks that I did go to, Memorial, was talking about this is B sub D because it's D quark here, but there's also B sub S, which is an S B bar, S bar B. And that's been seen too. This was seen fairly recently. And there's starting to be a tension now Yeah, just about the three sigma level between the consistency of all these pictures of how these oscillators work. So there may, you know, you have to wait a little bit to see if it really, three sigma is something that you don't really, it's just the borderline of amyloid chasing is three sigma. So the, you know, once they start throwing these things in, there's going to be a strong set of constraints, which are, which is actually what the, those constraints are what the cover of the book's about. This is a fit, which is taking all the constraints from these systems, and it's testing, you know, how it tests the standard model. And so it's quite plausible that they could see something there. So the other thing that was interesting from this meeting was that there's hints of Higgs physics at the Pematron. So there's a, but it's hints. And so the, they're hoping in Fermilab to find some evidence for the Higgs before the LHC turns on to try and scoop everybody into CERN. So whether they're going to pull it off or not, it'll depend. But watch for that, because if it happens, it'll be a big news story. So
what's a hint of the Higgs?
It's a slight excess of events in Higgs searches. So more than you would expect to see if the Higgs was there. So it's something which is not statistically significant at this point. I think with the Higgs, you always have to dig it out of the background. You know, it's producing, what you're really seeing is jets and electrons or muons or missing energy or something. And you have to find, you have to distinguish the Higgs from some background where you just, you know, QCD is giving you a similar kind of signal. And that's going to be always, the rule of thumb is, you know, you'd like to have five sigma for discovery. And I don't think the Pematron is ever going to be able to do that. But they could get to three sigma or more. And for the Higgs, it depends on exactly how massive it is. Because the more massive it is, the once it's above the mass of two W bosons, it can decay into two W bosons. And it likes to decay into the heaviest thing. So it'll mostly go to two W bosons. And then it's easier to pick that signal out of the background than it is to pick up the ones where it's decaying into bottom quarks, because top quarks could be bottom quarks too. So, and I'm not sure exactly where the best signal is, but it's, it was an interesting discussion anyway. So the main message there is that if you go to a meeting, never blow up a talk that you're skiing, because it's you could miss the announcement of DD Burt mixing. So I wrote the mesons down and I erased them again. So there's you got I'll write them again because I want to. If you imagine thinking of the Lagrangian of the standard model as being, you know, there's the strong interact, there's the things that strongly interact, and then there's the electromagnetic interaction, and there's the weak interactions. So this is all the stuff to do with the photons, and the stuff that's close to zero is AE close to zero, and this is the stuff which is, you know, depends on the W and Z. Then it's useful in low, at low energies when you're thinking about mesons. The useful way to divide the Lagrangian into the unperturbed and perturbed part is not to take the non-interactive piece and the interactions. It's just make the division here. So make this the unperturbed. And this is the perturbed piece. Then the eigenstates of your Hamiltonian in the unperturbed level are going to be the mesons and the protons and all the things you actually see in the strong interactions, because you're treating them exactly. And as long as you turn off the perturbations, then all the things that are symmetries of the strong interactions only, but not of the weak interactions, say, are symmetries, so that you'll find that the flavor is exactly conserved. So bottomness never changes, and topness never changes, and charmness never changes, because all the decays are happening because of this interaction. So it's a good approximation to think about things that are happening due to these interactions will be fast because they're not suppressed by any small couplings. Things that are happening because of these interactions will be slow. And in particular, when you're thinking about neutral mesons, like the ones I was talking about a second ago, When you're thinking those things, it's useful to think with and without these interactions turned on, because if you just had this, these things are labeled by conserved charges. In this case, the conserved charge would be strangeness. In this case, the conserved charge would be bottomness. In this case, the conserved charge would be both bottomness and strangeness. And so if I produced a beam of these things, you know, because they carry a charge, they're different from their antiparticles. And so that's why there's two different things here. If you produced a beam of these things, then you would never get these things. And the whole story of why these things are interesting is that there's approximate charges for the strong interactions that distinguish them. And they're always produced with the strong interactions. So the way you produce things like kaons is you have a beam of something which interacts with a nucleus, say, and a pair produces these things. And so the strong interactions are the ones that are happening the fastest. And they can produce pairs of these things all the time. So you tend to get these things, a lot of these things produced, but they're produced as KK bar pairs. And then because the thing that's producing them is the strong interactions, you're getting them being prepared in strangeness eigenstates or in bottomness eigenstates. And then later on, you're going to watch them decay, and that's going to be to do with stuff over here, which those are not good symmetries. And so the interplay between how they're produced and how they decay is useful, because it allows you to distinguish the effects of the propagation of these things, which couldn't have happened without the weak interactions, from the effects of their production. And because there's no exactly conserved charge which keeps these things from, which distinguishes these things, the actual exact eigenstates of propagation can be linear combinations of these things. And so these weak interactions are going to do two things. So if the weak interactions are turned off, then strangeness and barren and bottomness are conserved. And so are things like CP. And you're going to see that the evidence that CP is not a symmetry in nature comes from these systems. And it's because when you look at them propagating, all these things are not preserved. So when L weak is turned on, it does two things. It allows them to decay. Decaying B mesons decay. And it allows the basis of propagation eigenstates to be different from the flavor basis, which is called mixing. What I want to do is describe how these things behave. So the first part will just be phenomenologically describing how they behave, and the second part will be asking what would the standard model predict for how they behave. And so what we're interested in doing, rather than working with the quarks, let's just work with a field theory describing the mesons themselves. Call it effective field theory, but just forget why the effective is effective field theory. Describing the interaction. That's the basic idea of an effective field theory, is that if you think in terms of the quark fields that are in the standard model, the quark fields in particular, those create, you know, particles, the quarks. But those quarks are nowhere near the eigenstates of the strong interaction Hamiltonian, say. The eigenstates of that were these hadrons that were built with the quarks, the gluons. And we didn't care when we're looking at inclusive processes like Z goes to any hadron, because when you summed over all the states, it didn't make a difference what basis you used. But if we're interested in things like this, where we're actually following individual mesons around, it's more useful to think in terms of fields which are describing particles that are close to the eigenstates of the Hamiltonian of the unperturbed part of the system. And so we're weakly interacting, then that's more useful than to work with these, you know, fundamental fields, which are, in terms of which the Santa model is nice and easy to write, but it's but the eigenstates are not simply related to the fields. So the trade-off you get is that if you express things in terms of fields describing the degrees of freedom you care about, in this case these mesons, then the unperturbed part of the Hamiltonian is going to, or the Lagrangian, is going to be simple because it's going to be just basically weakly interacting things propagating. But the perturbation, the interactions are going to become complicated because if you try and re-express all the interactions involving the quarks in terms of these meson degrees of freedom, some of them you won't be able to do it, and for low energies where you can do it, it will be some complicated mess which will involve all kinds of terms. So as long as you're not interested in things that depend on the details of those things, it's worth your while to use these fields. So, and in particular, if we want to just look at propagation, that's just basically nothing happens. So what we're looking for is what's the free Lagrangian for these weakly interacting mesons. What are they? These things are mesons, so we know that they have no spin. We know that because it's the spins are opposite for the quark and the anti-quark, and there's no angular momentum between them, because that's what's the ground state. If it had angular momentum, it would have decayed down through the ground state, through the strong interactions. That's a fast process. And they have parity minus one, and they have charge conjugation, whatever it was, I think it's plus one. But for the purposes of this discussion, all we really have to care about is that it's a complex scalar field. It's complex because it's distinct from its antiparticle, and it's spinless. So the fields will be complex scalar field. And it's complex because the antiparticle is different from the particle. So A bar of the particle, there's no spin. And the non-interacting, so there's one more thing I have to tell you. We're interested in particular in how the weak interactions can make K and K naught, sorry, K and K bar turn into one another. And if you think about the weak interactions, so the point I want to make is that this happens, but it involves a selection rule that changes strangeness by 2 units. So if we're doing it for B mesons, it'll be changing B-ness by 2 units. It's delta S equals plus or minus 2 processes if possible. But if you think about the weak interactions always involves the things that break strangeness or bottomness are W boson interactions. And the thing involving a strange quark will always involve an up quark or a charm quark or a top quark. And if this is it always connects an up to a down type quark. So the basic interaction only changes strangeness or bottomness by 1 unit, not 2 units. So the only way you can get this thing to happen is to work at second order in the weak interactions. So, but the basic vertex satisfies delta S of 0 or plus or minus. It could be 0 because it might be a down and up quark. So it doesn't have to involve a strange quark. So that means we must work to the second order. So we're expecting that there'll be interactions which will so that means we're interested in effects order g Fermi squared. Now the important thing, the reason I'm kind of not writing the Lagrangian down yet is that there's an important complication which makes this story a little bit more difficult. And that is that if you're interested in propagation to that order, these things, when you turn the weak interactions on, these things all decay. And they can decay at first order in the weak interactions because, a strange quark can become an up quark or something. So that would be describing a kaon turning into a pion. So we know that these things can decay, and their decays are first order in the weak interactions, and we're interested in propagation effects that are second order. That means that we're going to know these things. We have to know at the order we're interested in that these things are not stable particles. So since these mesons decay through the same interactions, through S equals plus or minus one interactions, that means that their decay rate is also of the order of G Fermi squared, because the amplitude is order G Fermi, and when we square it to get the rate, we're going to get something G Fermi squared. And so that means we're interested in effects of the mass which are comparable to effects in the width of the particle. And so that means that if we watch the system long enough to see the oscillations we're looking for, where K is turning to K bars, there's some significant probability that we're going to also see a lot of them decay away. So we have to keep track of the fact that we're going to lose probability from these mesons into other things as they decay. Sometimes we have to track the loss of probability. And to do that, you know, we've talked about how to do that already in the past. So what we'll just do is we'll imagine taking the mass of we should think of the mass of these things, whatever they are, to be replaced by the mass minus I times the width over 2. And so the energy as a function of momentum, which was the square root of p squared plus m squared, if I make this shift and I linearize in gamma, that goes to the square root of p squared plus m squared. And then if I perturb in m, I get a minus I gamma over twice the square root of p squared plus m squared. But then the range. And that is just minus I, the momentum dependent width divided by 2. So this factor of m divided by the square root, that's just saying, that's expressing time dilation, that the lifetime is longer the faster you move. The faster, you know, this is, as p gets large, m over the square root of p squared plus m squared gets small. And that just says that the rate gets smaller than it was before, which means the lifetime's getting longer. And that's exactly the kinematic expression for time dilation for the lifetime. If you see a moving particle going by and decaying, it looks like it's living longer because its intrinsic decay width is defined in its reciprocal. That's why muons get to us from the top of the atmosphere. They live for a microsecond, but they get through, they travel more than 100 meters, which is as far as you can go in a microsecond going at the speed of light. They do that because they're moving relativistically and they live longer than a microsecond in our rest frame. So if we do that, the point is that the energy is not real in this approximation. And so when we write the field as being, you know, the integral d3p of e to the I px, in this case of p, plus e to the minus I px, in this case of a bar sub p, times factors, which I'm not writing here. There's two distinct things now. The CPT conjugate of this would be the thing I get when I actually, let's just do CP. It's the thing I gotta get when I replace particle with any particle. So I'll call that phi bar, and that'll be the integral d3p of the same stuff. Times e to the I of px, a bar of p. But that's not equal to phi star, because the px here contains a factor of the energy, and the energy is complex. And so I didn't, in going from here to here, complex conjugate the only thing that changes is the I. I didn't complex conjugate the p, which the order I'm working, if I'm really thinking of the energy as being complex because I'm keeping the width, and they keep track of the fact that probability is not conserved because these things are decaying, I have to distinguish phi from phi bar. And that's a bit counterintuitive. So having said that, what I want to do is I want to build a Lagrangian out of a phi and phi bar, which is quadratic because it's a free thing. And I want to know what I'm allowed to write down. So most. General quadratic. Describing propagation. Five particles. Well, I can always write the kinetic terms in a standard form, so let me just do that. So I'll have phi minus d mu phi bar. And I can always get rid of all the other terms. I could have had phi, d mu phi, plus d mu phi bar. And I'm just going to redefine those, redefine my fields to make the kinetic term standard. There's a 1 here rather than a half, because that's going to be the conventional normalization for complex fields. And then we have the mass term. And so the mass term, the thing you normally write would be phi phi bar, if you're thinking of phi bar being like a complex conjugate. But we can also have things like 1 half v phi squared plus c phi bar squared. And I don't have to make this thing be real anymore, because that's expressed in the fact that the things that, if probability is not conserved, then the evolution is not unitary, which means the Hamiltonian is not Hermitian, which is what the decay is expressing. So A, B, and C are complex parameters. And there's several limits which are useful. So special cases. So one special case would be, let me make sure I say the same ones that I say here. So one special case would be the limit where the phi carries a conserved charge. So charge constant. So that corresponds that the phi going to EVI L phi to the symmetry. Phi bar goes to even minus phi alpha. And so that corresponds to the case where B and C are 0 and A is non-zero. Right? Second special case is the case of CP conservation. So CP conservation, if CP is a symmetry, that's the replacement phi goes to phi bar. Symmetry under phi bar. And so you can kind of see that means that B has to be equal to C. That's it. And the last one is the case where things are stable, so it's unitary. So if unitary, that would be the case where phi bar is actually equal to phi star, and L is equal to L star. Because then that's saying that the reason these are different is no longer true. We have real energies. And the Hamiltonian is Hermitian. That corresponds to A being real, and B is C complex conjugate. So those are three useful limits, which I'll be referring to. So in the case, if this is supposed to, if for QCD, all three of those things are true for the mesons, if you only have the QCD particle ground describing things. And so in that case, both these terms are zero, and this is also real. And that would just be the mass squared in that case. So all three are true for LV equals zero. So in that case, B is C0 and A M phi squared, which is also real. But we're interested in the more general case. And it can only depend on these parameters, basically. And so the logic will be, we want to know how does, what are the eigenstates of propagation? Given this Lagrangian, then we want to diagonalize the mass terms, essentially, like we've been doing right along. And those will be the fields that once you produce them, they just rotate by phase. Or it won't be a phase, it'll be damped by the decay, but also rotating by phase. So the thing that goes like e to the minus iet will be some linear combination of phi and phi bar, which we get by diagonalizing that mass term. And the first thing we want to know is how the observables, like the k rates, and the various things you can measure when things are, when the basis of fields is not, the propagation basis is not phi and phi bar, how they depend on A, B, and C, because that'll give you an expression for things you measure in terms of those parameters, how they depend on those parameters. And then the second part will be, in principle, we can derive this Lagrangian from a standard model. And so we'll have an expression for these coefficients A, B, and C in terms of some graph involving quarks. And that's where that box graph I drew before is going to come in. And well, that'll give us an estimate as how big we expect these things to be and how these parameters depend on things like the mass of the can, mixing angles, and things like that. And once we have that step, then we have a bridge between the standard model parameters and the observables. So the first part is the observable, so approximations. So what we want to do is we want to diagonalize the mass term. And it's a little bit unorthodox because we're looking for linear combinations of phi and phi bar and not phi star. So let me just tell you the answer. So it's useful to define Z psi bar, Z inverse and psi bar. They're not complex conjugates. And Z is C over B. I've done that right. Yes. So that, with that choice, propagation eigenstates. Psi plus is just psi plus psi bar over root 2. Psi minus is pi over root 2 minus psi bar. Get that right. That is great. So the, now, so that says that for these guys, the kinetic term is just. The whole propagation thing just involves phi, phi bar, and the mass term is just, it'll be psi plus d mu psi plus d mu psi plus bar plus d mu psi minus bar. So there's nothing mixed up in the kinetic terms. The mass term with those redefinitions just becomes something times psi bar plus psi plus times psi plus bar plus something else times psi minus bar. So it becomes just two separate things that propagate. The time evolution of all the states involved is going to be e to the minus iet. E is complex because of that story. That just says that these things will have a decay rate and they'll have a mass. And so the states destroyed by these fields, so let's call it psi plus or minus. So if is the state destroyed by a plus or minus p, where psi plus or minus is the integral d3p and stuff times e to the I and px, a plus or minus p, so on. So I take the creation, I take the particle part and ask who is destroyed by that. So these things will have the same quantum numbers as the things that are destroyed by psi. Then psi plus or minus of p, in the approximation we're using, is just going to be e to the minus I, e plus or minus p times t or e plus or minus is that thing there. It would be square root of e squared plus m squared plus or minus minus I gamma plus or minus m plus or minus over the square root of, and I'm neglecting the second order of gamma. So the things you can observe are the mass and the width of these particles. And so all you're missing now is a formula for what that is in terms of the A, B, and C. And what to give you. So if U squared plus or minus is M minus M plus or minus minus I, M plus or minus 2. And the expression for mu is, where do we have it here? A plus or minus square root of UC. So it's a very simple expression. And so if you read off the real imaginary parts, you know, if you take the so A is A e to the minus I alpha, and B is B e to the minus I beta. I'm going to use alpha beta gamma because that's something that's just going to come up again later on. Let's see. Then, you know, if I want to read off the real part here, then you can see that M squared plus or minus is going to be A cos A. And I put M plus or minus gamma plus or minus is just going to be. There's a factor 2 here that's bothering me. I don't know if it's because I forgot it. That's coming from the square root. So that gives you an explicit way of, if someone hands you this Lagrangian A, B, and C, you can just, you're reading off what the physical masses and the widths are in terms of these parameters, so the real and imaginary parts of the modulus, the phase of A, B, and C. And it has all the right limits, right? You can kind of see that if we're in a unitary case where A is real and B is C star, well, A being real is a statement that little a is zero, so that's zero. And B is C star is a statement that B plus C here is zero, and that's zero. So the width goes away in a limit it's supposed to. And so on. You can just check that all those things, the implications of those symmetries make sense here. So how do you measure those things? How do you measure the mass or the width? The width you kind of measure by watching these things decay. But the interesting thing is, comes about now if you go back to this process of how they're produced. So, and I kind of told you that story before, but let me just say it again. So because the mesons, so K and K bar, are produced by strong interactions, for which strangeness is conserved. And they're typically produced starting from initial states that are not strange because these things decay. Pair produced. And arise as initial S eigenstates. So they're not produced in these plus or minus eigenstates. They're produced in a process which cares about the conservation of strangeness. So you get them as strangeness as eigenstates. And you can watch, you know, and so experimentally, you know, if a K was an S bar D, and it decays, say this decays by having the S decay through the weak interactions into a, has to decay into a lighter octet quark. So it has to be a U bar and a W, and the W will then decay into some else. So the W could be, say, a lepton and a neutrino. Remember this, the downside quarks have charge minus a third. So this is charge plus a third. This is charge minus two thirds. So we have to produce something with plus one unit of charge. So we're going to get a lepton here an electron or muon with positive charge, so it's an antiparticle. So then we have to get, for lepton number conservation, a neutrino here in the neglecting neutrino process. Whereas if the K bar decays, it's the whole story is the antiparticle that I told you about, so it's going to go to an up, an L minus, and a neutrino bar. And so you can tell kind of which one you have by looking at the charge of the lepton that is in the decay. So that's one way you can operationally decide which flavor that you have. So the sign, the charge. So what this would describe is this would be the process where K, this is a K, K naught, is going to an up bar or down is a pion. And it has to be, for charge reasons, it has to be pi minus and L plus a nu. And this would be the process where K naught bar goes to a pi plus L minus and a nu bar. Lepton is what tags the flavor of the meson. Initial meson, for example. So you're producing these things in flavor eigenstates. When you see them decay, you're measuring a flavor eigenstate, but they're propagating not as these flavor eigenstates. These states that you're producing and these states that you're seeing decay are linear combinations of the things that are propagating. And so that's what allows you to see oscillations. So, you can ask experimentally for the amplitude, start off with, say, phi and t, have phi at some sort of time zero, have phi at some later time t. So that rate square, that's the survival probability of phi goes to phi at some time. Or you can ask for the, you know, the process of where you start off with a phi, but you end with a phi bar. And those things can happen because in between, they were propagating the things that, this was really some linear combination of the plus and minus state, and then those separately evolved over here, and then they each had an amplitude for being in this final state. And so, yeah, that's simple quantum mechanics, and it's easy to write down what the amplitude would be. And then, I want to do this in terms of, there's a notation I wanted to give you over here. So this is now a conventional notation. So people in the literature are not going to give you formulas in terms of A, B, and C, which is what I'm going to do. So I want to make contact with what people do in the literature. So what I need to do is write the basis. I want to write these guys in terms of these guys. So the convention is to write psi plus is P I Q phi bar. And you normalize it. And sine minus. Tricky thing here is that I have type. So with that choice, to compare to what I told you before, P and Q is really this P over Q is Z squared. Z squared is C over B squared. I'll give them that conventional statement. All you have to do now is just insert the complete set of states, the initial time and the final time, which are the propagation eigenstates, and read off what the amplitudes are for evolution, given that they evolve according to these guys evolve in a simple way. So let me just tell you what that is now. So the the statement is that the phi g 50 is so that means that the probability that phi goes to phi is simple. 1/4 g to the minus gamma plus sort of times t. This is the momentum. The whole thing is a function of momentum. These things depended on, you know, they have a specific momentum. So this is the master formula that applies everywhere. That's why it's worth writing it down. So. Omega t, omega is just square root of p squared plus m squared plus minus the square root of p squared, m squared minus the difference of the energies. So that has two interesting limits. It's either m plus minus m minus, p is much less than m, or it's m plus squared minus m minus squared over p, 2p of p is much bigger than. So in the non-relativistic Earl de Weller, this little limit has those two forms. For these mesons, they're actually in practice going to always be pretty close to being non-relativistic. But when we talk about neutrinos, neutrinos are identical to this. Everything word for word, and it's they're in the relativistic limit. And so it's this particular combination that's going to be relevant one. So the thing you look for is you produce through some process these k's and k bars. Say you watch a k bar decay, so you know you've got a k in the pair production, and then later on you see a k decay. So you see the process you'd see is that you produce these guys. At some point there's a decay of a with a positive lepton, say, and some later point there's a decay of a negative lepton. And you're asking for the probability as a function of time separation. That's the observable. And this is telling you what that should be, how it depends on the properties of the Lagrangian. And so you can measure all these things separately. You can measure the, you know, the decays, the decay widths separately. You can measure this difference of masses separately because of this oscillation effect. And in particular, because of the oscillation, what's going to happen, because of the cosine, what will happen is that you have that probability has a it's not monotonically decreasing, right? You'll have a, it'll do something like, it'll do things like that. So it'll go down, different, it doesn't, it never gets quite down to, so when this is minus one, you've got a difference of squares, which is, so the smallest this gets is the difference of this minus this squared, which is never going to be zero. But it it has this oscillatory behavior, so it'll go down, but then it'll climb again, because what's happening is that you're seeing the rise of this cosine term. And so this is the oscillation signal. And by watching this as a function of time, you can measure not only how things are declared, the overall thing is damped, you know, there's an envelope here, which is controlled by these exponentials. And then there's the oscillatory point allows you to, by measuring the you know, where the troughs occur, you can pick off the frequencies. So you can really measure all these things in a convincing way. And what you find, so for kaons, that allows you to measure this mass difference. So delta m is measured in that way. And it turns out to be, I have to write this number because it's a fantastically small number. So it turns out to be 3.483. Times or plus or minus 0.006 times 10 to the minus 12 MeV plus 10 to the minus 15 GeV. You know, thought of as 1 over m. If you thought of this as being m of the mass of the kaon, the mass, this is the difference between two masses. If you thought of this as being the mass squared divided by another mass, this mass is not so far from the Planck mass. This is a really, really, really small number. And so, you know, the only reason you're able to measure a mass difference that accurately is because of this oscillation phenomenon. So it's it gives you an incredibly accurate measurement of a mass which would not have otherwise been available. So the point is that it's very accurate. And that's why, that's a large part of why it's such a good test of sound. Now, in practice for kaons, so now we need to step back and say, how is it different for kaons and for B mesons? Everything I've told you till now, to this point, is equally good for kaons and for B mesons. But now there's some specific features that are different between kaons and Bs. So I'm going to come back to this because a challenge is going to be. Maybe we should do this first. I'm going to do this first. So the challenge is can we get understand why that number is so small in the standard form? In the standard model, and I just want to get order of magnitude. I'm not going to, there's going to be a matrix element, which is going to be hard to do. And basically, that's the state of the art. The order of magnitude of this is understood in the standard model, but the factors of two up front are not understood, because that's to do with the matrix element of some interaction, some weak interaction, Hamiltonian, in the kaon state, and the kaon wave function, no one knows what the element are. So the 10 to the minus 15 you can get, the 3.483 is hard to get, theoretically. And so it's difficult to use this as a precise test of the factors of two. But the real utility here is in the 10 to the minus 15, because the things that change the standard model, you'll see that it's actually, the naive amp in the standard model is much bigger than this. And the fact that the standard model is this small comes about because of the cancellation. And it's the failure of that cancellation that you're sensitive to when you're looking at the deviation of the standard model. So in the standard model, we're looking for a process. Look for delta s equals plus or minus 2 process. And I showed you the first graph that does that in the standard model is something like this. So we have a d and an s, two w's. We have to have at least two w's to get this two units of flavor change. And so this is an up term. And the same thing could happen with the W's going that way and the fermions going that way. That's not a similar graph that we would have. So D, U, C, T, S. So there's graphs like this that can do it. And let's just estimate how big this sensor should be. What we're calculating here basically is we're calculating, you could think of this as being, we're calculating the weak interaction Hamiltonian Lagrangian as a function of the quark field. So we're going to get something here which is something like, let's call it k times, what I've got here is I've got an initial S quark, so I have a destroying an S quark, and gamma mu b star mu t bar s. We're getting this kind of a calculation will give us an effective interaction like this involving the quarks, and then what we have to do is take the matrix element of that between two kaons to get. So we'd like to know, what we'd like to know is this amplitude, which is so this would be something okay, bench weights. Let's call it curly C. So we want to take the matrix element. This takes a destroys an S quark, so that means that's something which is an anti K. So we're looking for something like this. And I shouldn't call that A because I've got A on E. I'm using this. Let's call this curly A. And that amplitude, if I compare that amplitude for standard model to what I would have got with this free thing, you know, the thing that's converting a K to a K bar, the thing that changes flavor by 2 units is the thing was the B or C term, right? So this is doing the analog of the, if I were to do the same thing in this in our effective theory, this is like calculated phi L phi bar. Where L here, I'm focusing on the thing that changes the flavor by 2 units. So it's the B phi squared term, the C phi bar squared. So if I compare this matrix element in the standard model to this matrix element in the spectral theory we're looking at, we're going to read off B or C in terms of standard model properties. So the thing is, my bottom line is I want to tell you what a formula is for B or C, and that would be the thing you'd plug into these expressions for the masses and the widths using those formulas we've talked about. Right. Right, so what do we want? Order of magnitude. So the naive, so let me give you the naive order of magnitude first. So we're saying that B or C, whatever it is, this has dimensions of mass squared, remember? Because that's the quadratic thing in the action. So this comparison, this is called a matching calculation. So I'm going to read off that these coefficients would have to be to mimic this. And what am I expecting it to be? Well, I know I've got a factor of 3 coupling constants, or 4 coupling constants. So it should go like the coupling constant for the W boson is the SO2 coupling constants. There's 2 to the 4th. I've got a loop, which is always a factor of 16 pi squared. When we counted the 2 pi's, that's what happened, if you remember. We've got 2 W boson propagators. But then there's a loop integral here, right? So we have this integral d4p with propagators involving, you know, p squared plus mw squared twice because of those two factors. And then there's fermion propagators as well, which are be here. On dimensional grounds, you know, this coefficient here, so let me do two parts. So I'm going to separate the calculation of this coefficient from the calculation of the matrix element. This whole thing has dimensions of mass to the 6th power because each fermion, you remember, has the mass dimensions of mass to the 3/2. 2 of them gave us mass cubed, so the coefficient of that in a Lagrangian was a mass. have two of these, we're going to have mass of the sixth. And so the coefficient of this in Lagrangian has to have dimensions of 1 over mass squared. So clearly C goes like 1 over mass squared. The main mass scale in this problem is MW. So naively, what you'd expect is that curly C should go like 1 over MW squared. So I'm giving an estimate as to why curly C goes like G2 to the 4th over 16 pi squared, 1 over MW squared. That's the dimensional analysis estimate, counting the two pi's, the coupling constants. That's what you'd expect of C. And then this comparison should say, let me put in one extra step here. Okay. This would be proportional to curly C, which has dimensions of 1 over mass squared. And then to make the dimensions up, we have to have another mass in the numerator to the fourth power. And if we're taking a matrix element, the only mass in the problem is basically the QCD scale. So that's my QCD scale and the Kn mass are basically the same thing. So that would be your estimate of how big this thing is. So that would be G2 to the fourth by 16 pi squared, and K squared to the fourth divided by W.
The difference in by the factor of 16?
Sorry?
You keep on writing over there 16 pi squared, over here you wrote.
Oh, pi squared inside the bracket, yeah.
Okay.
Thank you. It's 4 pi quantity squared. I pray my keys, but you might get the wrong message.
Ooh, sexual harassment.
All right. So now we go back to the, we know what the mass splitting is in some board that I hope we haven't erased yet. Here we are. So the mass splitting is coming from the plus minus term, right? So we're looking for the square root of BC, and if they're the same size, basically this is the mass splitting. So this is going to be of the order of delta M squared. Delta M is much less than M, the average of the two masses, and so delta M, you know, M plus squared minus squared is M plus M minus plus M minus. That means that this is basically, you know, M bar, 2 M bar times delta M. So if I want to know the mass splitting, given the difference in the mass splitting squared, delta M is going to be of the order of delta M squared over M or M bar. And those masses are all the Kn mass. So what I'm led to is that this should be something like G2 to the 4th over 16 pi squared MK cubed over MW squared. So just in order of magnitude, this is something like, you know, G over 4 pi is alpha. So we've got G squared over 4 pi is alpha. So we've got alpha squared cubed mk cubed over mw squared. So that's basically 10 to the minus 2, 10 to the minus 4. The Kn mass is half a GeV, so that's basically 1 GeV. So 1 divided by, and the W mass is 80 GeV, so let's say it's 100 GeV, just to get the ballpark right. So we're looking at something here, so we have 1 GeV cubed, so that's basically 10 to the minus, so this is 10 to the 4, 10 to the minus 8 GeV. All right, so we're nowhere near 10 to the minus 15, it's what the message is there. So the naive counting and coupling constants is way off, and it's off by order of magnitude. So either the estimate is wrong or the Santa model is wrong. And what saves it here is that there's an important, if you've got to follow in the sum over these three flavors of quark, is important because there's a big cancellation that's happening here. So the way to show you why this is what's happening in the standard model, why it's smaller than what I estimated for you, is to show you that if these things all had the same mass, or if they had all had zero mass, which is amongst the same thing, because except for the top quark, these things are very light, then the sum of these three flavor contributions cancels. So that although each term gives you something roughly that size, there's a cancellation amongst these three, which is important to understand. So let's see how that works. So So the, this is called the gym. This is one example of a gym mechanism. This is Glashow, Heliopolis, and Miami. So if we actually look at the flavor structure of that loop, is what I want to do. This, so the box graph has the form of sum over flavor up here on the top. And then there's, I want to follow the km angles on that around the vertices there. So we've got a v di. We got two sums here, right? The sum and the j, because there's two. We've got a v di. And I've got to make sure I get this right, because there's a couple of spongy around here, which I'm going to screw up otherwise. Sorry, I always get it wrong. So we've got a V, D, I, here's the I, here's J. And then we've got an S, I. Then we've got a V, D, J, V, S, J. All right, so I'm counting the KM angles here. Those four things. Keeping in mind that I know what the flavor is on the external lines here. And then there's a sum coefficient F, which is depends on the masses. It depends on the mass of the various up forks in the loop. Depends on NW. Depends on alpha. The graph doesn't depend on alpha strong the way I gave it to you, but it's there are strong corrections to it which will depend on alpha strong. And the important thing is that if this, so now the observation is if F were independent of I and J, which it would be if these masses were small compared to MW squared. And they are small except for the top four. Okay? Then what would happen is that we just have this sum would only see these matrices here. Then the amplitude is the goes like sum over I of V, D, I, star, V, S, I. And I think with that, that's V, dagger, V, D, S. In matrix notation. But this was a unitary matrix. So this is the unit matrix. This is delta, D, S. But because D is not equal to S, that's zero. If we'd done this where everybody was a D, we would have gotten 1. But because we've actually asked for flavors to change, so D is different from S, in both these cases, for the sum over J and the sum over I, this thing wants to be 0. And the only reason it won't be 0 is that this thing has to depend on these masses. So that the answer has to care about the mass of these guys. So if we say that, let's suppose now that all these masses are much smaller than MW squared, which is actually good except for the top quark. And I'll come back to the top quark later on. Then you can imagine Taylor expanding this thing. So that would mean that F would be approximately MI squared times some coefficient plus another coefficient MJ squared, and so on. Because the, F would be approximately some constant plus these things. But the constant we know drops out of the answer, so that we don't care what this thing is. In this sum, the first thing that would survive in that case would be these guys. And so that means that what was wrong with our estimate was that our estimate should have kept track of these v's, which are going to be small themselves. But it also had to be proportional to the quark masses. So that would mean that in our estimate up here, we should change it now. What we're missing here was a factor of say, there's going to be a term which is, let's say it's C1 times term squared mass divided by MW squared times the KM angles, so V, D term, V term, S, I'll put fun to get V squared. So I'm taking I equals J equals term there. There could be a term, m top squared over mw squared, and v d top, and v top squared. And there could be one where there's a term on one side and a top on the other side. places. So that changes the estimate now because we've got another factor of W squared. So now a better estimate would be delta M should be, you know, this G squared over MW squared is basically the Fermi constant, but now I've got two of them because I've got two MW squares in the denominator, so it'd be G Fermi squared. And then I've got to keep G Fermi was 16 pi squared goes along to the right. We've got a sum of terms, so there's C1 and top squared times, and then what are the dimensions? This is 1 over mass to the fourth. We have top squared here times these Kmn, I think. S top. And then on dimensional grounds, I have to have an mk on cubed. The fourth, so we have 1 over 4 powers of mass here. We got a mass here, so this will be 5 powers. So we get 2 here, 3. And now we need to know how big these things are. And you remember that the km angles, so if we have down, actually, normally we write these things with the up on the left. Okay. Not too bad. Normally you write up, term, top, down, strand, bottom. And you remember, basically, these were 1 on the diagonal. This was lambda. This was minus lambda. Basically, you paid a price of lambda. The further you went off the diagonal, the more powers of lambda you paid, where lambda is essentially 0.2. Right back in the very beginning of the year, I told you that. And that allows us to count things here. So the this should, let me write this the way I should have written it. Up should be on the left. So we're, if I want to know the relative size of these terms, this is something which goes like mt squared. And if td squared is this guy, so it's lambda cubed squared. And then ts is this guy squared. So that's the 10th. Whereas this is m term squared times cd is this guy, it's lambda squared. And CS is 1. And then there's also the PC term. If you put in the numbers here, the 0.2 wins. Even though the M top is 170 GeV, and M term is basically 1 GeV, 10 powers of 0.2 actually kill you in the end. And so if this were 1, this is something like 0.04. And the thing I'm not writing over here is like 0.08 or something like that. So it happens to the strange quark. It's the term quark that wins because the penalty of paying for these small mixing angles is worse than the bonus of getting a big mass thing. If we did the same thing for the B quarks, where we had B quarks on the external lines, so this is now B, then that changes the calculation because now, if this had been a B here instead of an S, you know, in that case, we've got VTD is lambda to the sixth still, but now VTB is 1. And here, VCD is lambda squared, and VCB is lambda squared squared, which is going to be lambda to the sixth. So when we put B quarks in, these factors are the same. And so then the top quark mass wins. So the upshot is that, so for KK bar mixing, it's the term quark which wins in that graph. But not by a whole bunch, by a factor of 100, or maybe 25, 27. But for BB bar mixing, it's the top quark that wins. This one wins because of the KM suppressions. But this one wins because of when T squared is so large. And if you put in the total, now I'm getting a full board. The total order of magnitude, right? We've got delta M, in the end of the day, was G Fermi squared, MK on cubed divided by 16 pi squared times let's do the KK Bar one. So it was m charm squared times lambda squared, right? So d Fermi is 10 to the minus 5 GeV squared. M kaon is basically 1 GeV cubed. 16 pi, you know, pi squared is 9, which is 10. 16 is 10. So 10 squared is 100 times 10 is 1,000. And then the charm quark is again a GeV squared. And then this is 0.2 squared, which was 0.2 squared is 0.04. So that's basically, let's say that's 0.1.
You're going to be off by 10.
If I'm off by 10, I'm doing well.
you did the 16 pi squared thing again.
Well, actually, when I put the numbers in, I did it right, didn't I? Or, no, I got one factor 10, didn't I? Right. So what do we got? We got 10 to the minus 5, 10 to the minus 10, 10 to the minus 12, 10 to the minus 13.
Yeah.
Actually, if you do this, if you're a little more careful than this, and you keep this, I actually got 10 to the minus 15 when I did it in the book. So I'm just being particularly sloppy in the factors here. Because 16 isn't actually 10.
Wait.
But you can see that anyway. You can see that you're, you know, you're getting down in the ballpark where this within the error, the approximation to making, you know, we were off by 8 orders of magnitude or 7 orders of magnitude before. Now we're within factors of 10 to the 100. That means you want to look more closely and do this calculation more carefully. And if you do it, it actually works. So the main lesson, a good place to break here now, is that the standard model works. It works because of a delta cancellation. And so modifications of the standard model that don't preserve that cancellation tend to show up in this mass shift by an amount bigger than the standard model, even though you've modified the standard model by a small amount. Because the standard model, you're seeing an accidental cancellation of the standard model in cancer. So it's a very sensitive probe to restrict new physics. And it's a sensitive probe because you can see masses that are that incredibly small, and you can only see them because of this whole displacement problem, which allows you to measure frequencies extremely well. There's a whole another story here to do with CB violation. The whole story I told you now is just to do with how things oscillate, how they decay. But the evidence, the first evidence that CP is violated is also in this story. And I want to give you that spiel too, because there's a similar estimate to how big the CP violation should be, like the one I just gave. The main difference is now we have to start looking for where the phases are in this matrix, and they're all up here and down here. And so if we follow specifically those terms to see the CP violation, then you can also account for the generic size that you see in the standard model. So it's a very, very successful picture. But it's very intricate in that sense. So you're getting everything out of these same matrices that you're measuring in a whole bunch of different ways. And so the redundancy in the test of the standard model, and the reason people really push these systems, these meson systems, is that you're really saying that a whole bunch of things are measuring the same parameters. And if that's the wrong picture, you'll find that you're going to start getting different measurements for them. For what should be the same thing, different measurements, different ways of measuring the same things here will give you different answers if the standard model is not right. And so far, it has been right. But that three sigma thing I was telling you about was in the context of these consistency checks of the KM. Any questions about that?
The
thing is that if you. It's literally mass. And the thing is that.
It's a mass of
K. Well, so that's an ambiguous statement. The thing is, there's. We talked about K naught and K naught bar. But if I just take. If I ask you what a mass is, it's going to be. I take something and I just let it go. It just sits there or it moves along and it has an energy which is P squared plus M squared or something. These don't do that, right? Because they turn into each other. So the things that have a mass are the things that just sit there and complicate. And that's not these guys. They're typically called K long and K short. This is what I was calling K minus. This is actually what I called K. So the K plus and the K minus, those are the things that have a mass. And it doesn't make sense to say what these guys' mass is, because to have a mass, you have to just sit there and just propagate. And so. When you actually look at these things decaying, one of them, it turns out, the reason they're called long and short is that this one is long-lived and this one's short-lived for reasons I haven't told you about yet. And so one of these things actually, it's actually very beautiful, because what happens is that these guys die on you really quickly, and the other ones take longer to die. So what happens is that the longer you wait, the more you just get these guys. And they're almost equally mixed between K and K bar. But if you put your beam through matter again, so here you can have a pure K short, K long beam, because you've watched the K short solve the K away. And you can tell because you just look for the leptons that they're decaying into and they're not there. But then when you come up this side, all of a sudden you've got half and half K long and K short again. And that's because when they interact with nuclei, what happens is that if a kaon is going to interact with a nucleus, you know, you've got a nucleus which is an up and a down or something like a proton. Then you've got a kaon which is a K bar. You've got a strange and maybe a down bar. You can have a reaction where you exchange the down and the strange. So these things can go to up, strange, and down bar. So that would describe a process where K bar naught plus a proton goes to a positive pion and what's called a sigma meson. It's a strange variable. But if you did the same thing with a K, where this is an S bar D, you can't do the exchange because there's no antiparticles in the nuclei. And so that what you find is that K bars are really easily absorbed by nuclei when you pass through matter, but K's aren't. They just go right through. And so what's happening here is that you're essentially getting a pure K not beam. And so what you get is that's about 50-50 K long and K short. So you can, these decays that all decay away, as soon as you put the beam through matter, they come back again. And so you start seeing the K short decaying away again. So you can really see that these things are oscillating back and forth in detail. And that's actually how they measure the sign of this mass difference. They know which one is heavier because they can, the sign of that sign you can measure in this kind of a process where you're not just watching this decay. So they're very beautiful experiments. They tell you a lot about the center moment. All right. Good to know.